May the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be acceptable to you, Holy Wisdom. Good morning. Every year as Lent approaches, I consider what to ask God to help me with, and my Facebook habits come up. My status has not changed since 2009. Word on the street is that I'm an introvert. I have always loved people, especially one at a time. And I've also slipped off to secret, quiet places ever since I can remember. Up a tree, on the roof, under stairs and large hibiscus bushes, unlocked chapels, window wells, and some other places my mother doesn't know about. In search of the delicious company of water, of trees, of words, and of course, myself. How funny and fun and totally anxiety-producing it would be to commit to updating my Facebook status once a day for the 40 days of Lent. How hard could it be to change my photo or post a picture of what I'm about to eat, something really Lenten like a juicy hunk of meat? It wouldn't even have to be true. But every year... But every year I decide that, no, God loves introverts too. And inner voices remind me that I have so many other faults higher on the list. But this sermon isn't going to be a social media rant, at least not overtly. Some of my best friends are on Facebook. I'd like to suggest instead that solitude is a way of guarding the heart and might be essential for learning a hospitality of heart that can truly welcome others. In biblical Hebrew, the heart is not only where we feel feelings, but also where we think and make choices. Science has come to agree with Old Testament spirituality that there's no clear distinction between mind and body or between our inner and outer lives as we imagine. Our heart includes feelings, thoughts, desires, commitments, and all that happens in our center. Our heart flows into word, action, form, relationship. Our heart, our deepest center, is hidden in God, veiled to ourselves and to others. In Proverbs, wisdom is said to dwell in the heart. Proverbs 4:23 says, "Guard your heart above all else, for from it flow the springs of life." And a little later, the Proverbs parent teaching the way of wisdom says, "Drink water from your own cistern, flowing water from your own well." These verses inspired the title of a 1960s Latin American bestseller, as books of theology go. We drink from our own wells. In it, Gustavo Gutierrez, a Peruvian, known now as the father of liberation theology, argued that authentic Christian spirituality is experienced in the creative tension between action and contemplation, in both the struggle for political freedom of a particular people in a particular place and prayer. Henry Nouwen, whose heart has nurtured many of us, was deeply influenced as a student and friend of Gutierrez by this integration of the struggle for spiritual growth and the struggle for political freedom. In Nouwen's now classic, also classic guidebook, Reaching Out, he identifies three essential movements of the spiritual life. Moving from loneliness to solitude is the first. Reaching out to know and welcome ourselves and to experience God's welcome, says Nouwen, is the basis for the other two movements, which he names from hostility to hospitality and from illusion to prayer. We all keep learning and relearning, and it's not a straight line. Sometimes it's being received by another that allows us to welcome ourselves. It's a wonderful surprise to me to have Nina Lanto here this morning. Many of you probably know her. Without her, I would have many times lost the will to live. If you are thinking that all this solitude, silence, and prayer business is for introverts, monks, and lady poets, listen up. German theologian and pastor Dietrich Bonhoeffer started an underground seminary during Hitler's Third Reich, hoping to create a Christian community with a depth of faith capable of resisting the evil he saw arising in his country. He encouraged students to, quote, dwell in the word, rest in prayer, support one another, and turn in solidarity to those most vulnerable in society. Dorothy Day, giant of picket lines and poverty, wrote, sorry, my printer did not get that quote in. My strength returns to me with my cup of coffee and the reading of the Psalms. Now and himself was actually a high-energy extrovert. His students and friends report that he was often distractingly wiggly during silent centering prayer. It's hard to be Mennonite. You have to feed the hungry and give drinks to the thirsty. You have to welcome strangers and clothe the naked, take care of the sick, take care of and visit those in prison, not to mention chair setup. But we North American progressive Mennonites tend to view solitude and silence and even personal prayer and, God forbid, rest a little suspiciously. As Julia Kasdorf wrote in her poem, Mennonites, we clean up God's disasters. Isn't it selfish to water your own garden when there are so many people who are literally thirsty? Isn't it irresponsible escapism to close the gate in a time when what passes for governance is fake news and fisticuffs? When wisdom calling out in the streets sounds like gunshots and four-letter words in no more than 140 characters. Isn't welcoming strangers and tending those left for dead what Jesus, the one we have decided to follow, did all the time, even unto death? About a year ago, I read an interview with Lakota poet Layli Long Soldier. She says, what I've been thinking about a lot is Standing Rock, and how firm that community has been on keeping prayer as central to everything. And I think that's something very beautiful and unique that Standing Rock has offered to the world of resistance. I don't know if many people are aware of that, how important prayer is to Lakota life, but I always get a kick out of it. I had a nephew who was complaining to one of my cousins, my sister, and he was saying, it's hard to be Lakota. All we do is pray, pray, pray all the time. It seems to me that much of the current political and social disaster around us is an outward sign of an inward reality. We have neglected to guard our hearts. We have neglected the healthy boundaries that allow hospitality of heart to grow. The border wall is a vast and violent expression of our cultural inability to create safe spaces, to build good fences around our own thoughts and feelings, our motives, our deepest intimacies, our family life, our commitments, our congregational life, perhaps. If good fences make good neighbors, it's not because they keep out those who are different or in need, but because gates closed with awareness set priorities and keep out frenzied distractions. Long enough for us to get to know ourselves, and long enough for us to get enough sleep. Closing the gate beside the still waters allows God to restore our souls. Ho, everyone who thirsts, come to the water. Why do you spend your money and your labor for that which does not satisfy? Nouwen writes, every time you close another door, the door of immediate satisfaction, the door of distracting entertainment, the door of busyness, the door of guilt and worry, or the door of self-rejection, you commit yourself to go deeper into your heart and thus deeper into the heart of God. This is a movement toward full incarnation. It leads you to become what you already are, a child of God. It lets you embody more and more the truth of your being. It makes you claim the God within you. End quote. There are some good ideas for Lent, closing the door of worry or self-rejection. I I don't mean to sentimentalize aloneness. Human beings cannot survive without relationship. All of us are lonely some of the time, even when surrounded by people. The loneliness of those who are alone, not by choice, those who have outlived their siblings and friends, those who've lost a partner or a child or a family or long for one, is terribly painful. I tend to think Jesus' aloneness in human terms is one of the ways he chose to identify fully with even the most painful realities of being human. We need each other. But times of aloneness, whether chosen or not, can bring us face to face with our demons, with our need for beauty, our longing for freedom, our longing for God. Aloneness can allow us to hear wisdom calling in our own body, heart, mind. Like the voice that calls to the first earth people hiding in that long ago garden, ashamed to have surrendered their integrity. Where are you? I still want to be friends. Like the still small voice that asks Elijah when he's given up on his prophet job and run away in despair to a cave in the wilderness. What are you doing here? The voice that confounds Mary alone in the invisibility of her ordinary girl life. You are the agent of change we've been waiting for. Don't be afraid. The voice that says to Jesus in his solitude amid the crowd at the Jordan, I love you. You are mine. And then immediately go away from the likes and friend requests to where you cannot escape the pain or the joy of accepting responsibility for your own life. Close the gate, drink from your own well, and discover what it means to become who you are. Most of us know the story of Jesus in the wilderness. But though we tend to hear them as little throwaway comments or not at all, references to Jesus' solitude and silence are everywhere in the Gospels. It's how he began his ministry. It's how he made important decisions. It's how he dealt with troubling emotions like grief. It's how he dealt with the demands of his work and cared for his soul. It's how he taught his disciples. It's how he prepared for important ministry events. It's how he prepared for his death. It's how he deepened his love relationship with the one he knew as Papa. Here are just a few of the times when Jesus practiced what I preach. From Luke 5, 15 to 16, crowds of people came to hear him and to be healed of their sicknesses, but Jesus often withdrew to lonely places and prayed. From Matthew 14, 13, when Jesus heard that John the Baptist had been beheaded, he withdrew by boat privately to a solitary place. Mark 6, 31 to 32. Because so many people were coming and going that they did not even have a chance to eat, Jesus said to the disciples, come with me by yourselves to a quiet place and get some rest. So they went away by themselves in a boat to a solitary place. Jesus did a lot of walking, sometimes alone, like in John 7, the 5-day walk from Galilee to Jerusalem. I see some of you walking. Solitude might be biking to work or school or along the pumpkin vine trail. Maybe you literally tend a garden. Maybe you ski. When I am living right, I go away from home overnight once a month. And as you might guess, I'm a pretty sluggish activist, which is one reason I'm at Assembly. Without all of you, it would take me years to write a letter to my congressperson. I need us. Maybe you keep Sabbath. This fall, I heard an interview with a woman named Only Love Alston. She is the executive director of Faith in New York, a multi-faith citywide network of congregations committed to faith-rooted community organizing. She's also a member of the Sojourners Board. Only Love is under 40 African-American, and a member of a Hebrew Pentecostal congregation, a Christian community that observes Jewish practices and holidays. The interviewer asked about the violent events that had recently happened in Charlottesville, Virginia, and she said that she did not even find out until that evening because during the Friday evening before and Saturday, she was keeping Sabbath with her church community, which apparently involved no phones. She also told how in apartheid South Africa, Sabbath-keeping congregations had to register with the mainline denomination because Sabbath-keeping was connected to so many uprisings. Quote, "On Sabbath, you have time to think, am I really free? What are my relationships like? You start to throw away what doesn't free you. I do respect a community that engages collectively and purposefully in visible weirdness." I can't imagine where that comes from. Hospitality is making room within ourselves for another. We know this, but it's so easy to forget. Slowing down long enough and regularly enough to get to know the strangers within our own hearts is how we learn to slow down, notice, and get to know the strangers around us and among us. So friends, let us guard our hearts. 6 days you shall work and share opinion pieces and fill up every minute of the day with being a good neighbor as best as you can. But on the seventh day, or whenever you can, but make it a habit, you shall stop. Close the gate behind you. Lower the bucket into your own well. Start with what's easy and keep challenging yourself. If you write or paint or used to play the piano, dust it off. Many of us pray through music. Listen as kindly and respectfully as you can to your anger and cynicism and loneliness or whatever shows up. Be curious about prayer. Maybe something like, "Look, God, here's this mess. Please help me with it." Think of it as sociopolitical resistance. Then open the gate and come out. True evangelical faith cannot lie sleeping. That's Menno Simons. Open the gate and come out. Let hospitality of heart lead you. Let wisdom lead you. Like any art, poetry is essentially reporting back from deep solitude. This story poem is from Naomi Shihab Nye. There isn't a well in it, but I think you'll hear the connections. It's called Gate A4. Wandering around the Albuquerque airport terminal, after learning my flight had been delayed for 4 hours, I heard an announcement. "If anyone in the vicinity of Gate A4 understands any Arabic, please come to the gate immediately." Well, one pauses these days. Gate A4 was my own gate. I went there. An older woman in full traditional Palestinian embroidered dress, just like my grandma wore, was crumpled to the floor, wailing. "Help," said the flight agent. "Talk to her. What is her problem?" We told her the flight was going to be late, and she did this. I stooped down to put my arm around the woman and spoke haltingly. "Shudowa, shubiduk habibti, stanishwe, minfadlik, shubitsewi." The minute she heard any words she knew, however poorly used, she stopped crying. She thought the flight had been canceled entirely. She needed to be in El Paso for major medical treatment the next day. I said, "No, we're fine. You'll get there. Just later. Who is picking you up? Let's call him." We called her son. I spoke with him in English. I told him I would stay with his mother till we got on the plane and ride next to her. She talked to him. Then we called her other sons, just for the fun of it. Then we called my dad, and he and she spoke for a while in Arabic and found out, of course, they had 10 shared friends. Then I thought, just for the heck of it, why not call some Palestinian poets I know and let them chat with her? This all took up 2 hours. She was laughing a lot by then, telling of her life, patting my knee, answering questions. She had pulled a sack of homemade mamul cookies, little powdered sugar, crumbly mounds stuffed with dates and nuts, from her bag, and was offering them to all the women at the gate. To my amazement, not a single woman declined one. It was like a sacrament. The traveler from Argentina, the mom from California, the lovely woman from Laredo, we were all covered with the same powdered sugar and smiling. There is no better cookie. And then the airline broke out free apple juice from huge coolers, and two little girls from our flight ran around serving it, and they were covered with powdered sugar too. And I noticed that my new best friend, by now we were holding hands, had a potted plant poking out of her bag, some medicinal thing with green furry leaves. Such an old country tradition. Always carry a plant. Always stay rooted to somewhere. And I looked around that gate of late and weary ones, and I thought, this is the world I want to live in, the shared world. Not a single person in that gate, once the crying of confusion stopped, seemed apprehensive about any other person. They took the cookies. I wanted to hug all those other women, too. This can still happen anywhere. Not everything is lost.